Tonight you're going to want to go outside, and tonight we're hoping for clear skies, and tonight you will find, depending on where you are, a near total lunar eclipse sometime later this evening after dark. And here to tell us about that and everything else in our celestial skies is Jim Lattice, former director of the UW Space Place, former manager of the Washburn Observatory, and a recently retired faculty associate in astronomy at the UW-Madison College of Letters and Sciences. And if you have a question about what you're seeing in the skies, we welcome you to our conversation this hour. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. What are you seeing or what are you looking for? And Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Lee. It's great to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you because space always makes me think. It provides the ponderous. You know, there is a great unknown out there that reminds me not only about how much we have yet to learn, but also my place in this world. That, you know, you remind yourself of how small you can actually be and yet how important you can become.
That's one of the most valuable things about this is, it gives us many different perspectives on our place in the universe, but it's also just fun, and it has practical uses, too, when you can look up into the sky and recognize a few constellations. So it's really a wonderful hobby.
You can find yourself on this Earth just by looking at the skies.
You can, indeed. Yeah, you could just sort of be transplanted and look up into the sky, and you'd have some idea where you are.
And although I don't feel it, I know we're hurtling through space at, like, an ungodly speed.
Yeah, well... Right. All that kind of stuff. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's you have to sort of separate out all those various sorts of things, because sometimes it doesn't matter that we're hurtling through space. And other times it does. It's sort of your frames of reference kind of things. But it does. That's an important thing about astronomy is it does teach us to think in terms of frames of reference. Do we want to think about the Earth as a sphere that we're moving with respect to, or do we want to think about the Earth as a planet moving with respect to the Sun, or do we want to think about the Sun moving with respect to the galaxy? In order to understand a lot of astronomy, you have to be able to shift these, just mentally shift these frames of reference. It used to be something that I would emphasize in teaching astronomy is that not only do you have to be able to do this to get a good grade on the exams, but it's fun. I mean, it really is an important, I think, a sort of a grounding thing for people as individuals to understand where they are. And, of course, one of the things that we talk about most in astronomy these days is where we came from.
Yes.
In fact, just to the Madison Astronomy Department recently formed a couple of years ago what's called the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research, which is a multidisciplinary way of combining not just astronomy with but other associated fields, chemistry and mathematics and a few other things, in order to address what are, in some senses, big philosophical questions, but they're becoming big astronomical questions as we discover more exoplanets, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, 6,000, I think, is the number these days. We can begin to say that we know something about the distribution of planets. And when I was in college, there was, you know, no other planets were known outside of the ones around our sun.
Our solar system was kind of the limit, and the debate was where Pluto fit into it. But beyond that, we found thousands of planets to look at, research, and figure out.
Right. So not only, I mean, just the fact that they're there was an important thing, but we're beginning to get to numbers now where you can make generalizations about what different types of planets there are, how typical is this one compared to another one, or things like that. So we still need to find a lot of planets, because 6,000 in the whole galaxy, where there are probably trillions of them, is still a small number.
We're just getting started. Where does Earth fit in what we would expect from an exoplanet? Is this atypical so far?
So far it is, yeah. The search is very much on to find an Earth 2, they sometimes call it, to find something that looks like Earth as near as we can tell, because it would be interesting to know whether we're typical. That most of the ways of discovering exoplanets are not very sensitive to planets like Earth. So the Earth is orbiting a relatively bright star compared to where we find most of them, and it's a relatively small, that is a small, relatively small mass planet and a relatively massive star.
So the methods that we have now are biased a little bit towards finding really massive planets around really little stars.
Easier to find the Jupiters and Saturns than the Earths and Mercuries.
The easier to find the Jupiters and Saturns, or even more massive ones, but around much less massive stars. They have that much more effect on the small star, that a much more visible. It's a change in the spectrum of the star that you actually look for to detect the planet.
So as the planet moves in front of it?
Well, that's another method,
okay.
That's called the transit method, mm-hmm. and that is another way to find planets, but they're a planet like the Earth passing in front of the sun is harder to detect.
Sure.
Compared to some other situations.
Which brings us to the lunar eclipse tonight as the Earth passes between the sun and we will see it projected on the moon. How good of a view will Wisconsin have by and large with given some clear skies tonight, Jim? How good will it be and when will we see it?
Yeah, the weather does look promising for a lot of us, and it's going to be, as you say, it's a transit, the Earth getting in the way of the sunlight, falling on the full moon. So we're going to see the full moon tonight, and the Earth's shadow has an outer zone that we call the penumbra, which means partial shadow. Really, and then there's the deeper part, what's called the umbra of the Earth's shadow, which is if you were in the umbra, then the Earth is completely blocking out sunlight, and if you're in the penumbra, then you're getting partial sunlight, partial shadow. That penumbral start, when the moon first enters the penumbra of the Earth, will be at about 8:24 p.m. So that's it's a very gradual sort of event. It's almost unnoticeable. You stand there and you watch and think, yeah, I think maybe that's...
Am I seeing something?
I'm seeing it. Yeah, I think so, right. So that one is subtle.
Okay.
And sometimes some lunar eclipses are never any deeper than a penumbral eclipse. And those, be honest, I won't even get off the couch for. it's just so...
Not worth it.
But then what's interesting is that about an hour later, 9:34 is the time I've got here, but just call it roughly an hour later, the moon enters the Earth's umbra. And that's total darkness, or close as it comes. And so there you see an actual darkening of the disk of the full moon. You see an actual little chunk out of it. Not quite, because you can still see the rest of the moon behind there. But you can distinctly see the edge of the Earth's shadow, that curved edge, and that's important, too. We could come back to that. But so then that will be deeper and deeper until there will only be a little bit of the moon left unimmersed in the umbra, and that will be at about 11:13, call it 11:15. So, yeah, so it's kind of slow, and slow in a way.
Yeah, you can just, about an hour and 45 minutes for it to get to almost full eclipse.
Yep. So, it doesn't matter if you're out at that special moment. It's a little bit different from solar eclipses where, if you go to a total solar eclipse, you can almost, blink and you'll miss it.
Right.
It's not quite that bad, of course. But minutes, we're talking about mere minutes of totality at a total solar eclipse, whereas these lunar eclipses are nice, slow events. So, yeah, no need to sweat exactly what time you get out there. Or you can just, like me, I'm going to set up a lawn chair and watch the whole thing. Well, actually, not the penumbra. I'll probably be setting up my lawn chair during the penumbra eclipse. But, that totality, not the totality, that the umbral eclipse, I guess, is the right thing to call it, goes on until almost 1 a.m., 12:52 a.m. is. Now, the thing about most of these eclipses is they look the same going out as coming in.
Sure.
So you don't have to feel guilty about deciding it's time to go to bed at 11:30.
If you got to work tomorrow.
Yep, exactly. But that's if you're gonna do the whole thing, then the partial eclipse ends at 12:52, and then there's the penumbral. So this is just happening in reverse of how it developed at the beginning. Not until a little after 2 a.m. So if you really, really wanted to say you saw it from beginning to end, that'll be quite a commitment.
It's like 3.5 hours.
Is that what it is? Boy, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And this is a lunar eclipse that much of the world's going to be able to see, but will they be able to see it as completely as you're describing it for us here in Wisconsin?
It's going to be the same pretty much anywhere on Earth you see it. Yeah, it's the shadow covers the whole Western Hemisphere, so all of South America, and then way up into Canada. I forget where the cutoff is. It's in northern Canada, so most of North America as well. So yeah, the only difference will be how high in the sky the moon appears as you're looking at it. So if you go further south, if you go down to the equator, the moon will be quite high in the sky. We're going to be seeing it low in the south, southeast to south, during the relatively low. Now, low enough, in fact, that I can't watch it from my backyard. My neighbor's house will definitely block it out.
You're going to need
to
find a
I'm going
higher
over
ground.
To a park. Yep.
Or Orton Park.
A park.
Okay.
No, not a particular park. But yeah. But
is there a good? I mean, is it like star watching? Do you need to find a dark place to see this? Or
not in this case. Okay. I mean, you know, it is a long eclipse, so a lot of as lunar eclipses are. So a lot of people do like to do some stargazing as you're kind of waiting for the eclipse to dawdle along there. But no, you don't need to find a dark sky. But it's nice to have a dark sky. One thing that will happen as the moon gets nice and dark, so the full moon will pretty much wash out the Milky Way, even if your urban lighting hasn't already done that. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a dark location, even a full moon will make it almost impossible to see the Milky Way. But during the deepest part of this eclipse, it's going to look pretty good. So
stars are going to start lighting up.
They're going to really show up in numbers. So that might be a motivation to go to a dark sky, but no, you don't necessarily need to. So if you can see it from the balcony or the back porch or wherever you are, if you can see into the south, relatively low into the southeast sky, then you can see it
all the way until about 2 o'clock this morning, starting at about 8:24 tonight, to be precise.
8:24, I'd say the most interesting stuff though is closer to 9:30.
9:30 until about just before 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yep. I mean, if I were advising anybody who wanted to minimize the amount, the time commitment, I would say 9:30 until 11:15 is just about the most interesting.
Did we have a solar eclipse earlier this summer? Was there some? I don't know if we had it here, but there was a solar eclipse earlier this
just
summer.
Just 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Yep. Which is not coincidental. They happen, solar and lunar eclipses happen
together
2 weeks apart in pairs, right?
Why is that?
Typically pairs. Well, we're talking about an alignment. Mm-hmm. Either it's for a solar eclipse, it's an alignment of the sun and the moon and the earth in that order. So the moon is getting in the way of the sunlight, right? And in the case of the lunar eclipse, the alignment is sun, earth, moon in that order. So the moon is moving through the earth's shadow, right? So imagine a solar eclipse. You have to have a near perfect, doesn't have to be perfect, but a near perfect alignment, because the shadow of the moon on the Earth's surface is pretty small. It's about 100 miles wide, maybe, something like that.
Yeah.
Depends on the eclipse. If you're not in that location, that track, that narrow track on the Earth, you don't see the total solar eclipse. So it goes by kind of quick, but that's going to be as close as possible to your perfect alignment. So now 2 weeks later, the moon has gone from new moon at the solar eclipse to full moon on the other side.
Yeah.
But that the earth and moon have moved in their orbit around the sun a bit. So the alignment can't be perfect anymore. So you'll get, if you get a total solar eclipse, then you'll get either 2 weeks before or 2 weeks after, you'll get a partial lunar eclipse. And if you really get a great central lunar eclipse, then either 2 weeks before or 2 weeks after, you'll see a partial solar eclipse somewhere in the world.
So all these heavenly bodies are moving through space at astronomical speeds, but they're all moving in concert. I mean, they're all through as gravitational forces pull and push each other, that there is a science or math to it that seems to be a universal language, an astronomical language.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the problems like predicting, say, a solar eclipse were beyond the science of astronomy. Astronomy is a very old science, but not until really Newtonian gravitation came along. So we're talking the early 1700s. Could people start making accurate predictions about where on Earth you might be when there's a solar eclipse, when there's a total solar eclipse? And that's because of understanding of that, all those interactions, those gravitational interactions, which in the case of the Earth and the Moon and the Sun are relatively complex, still a fairly complex problem. Not that it isn't solved at this point,
right.
But it helps to have some computers cranking away on these things to get accurate predictions of.
And also it gives us an idea of those exoplanets way out there beyond our solar system.
A different kind of eclipse.
But still the same math, though, right?
Well, right. So they look at an at a transit. They look at it. They look at a transit there and derive what information you can about it, and try to derive the orbit of that. Of that planet, what is that? What is that like? Now, the other method gives you a little bit better. The radial velocity method gives you a little bit better information about that. Tells you a lot about the orbit quite directly, but doesn't tell you as much about the planet. The transit part, they can actually see as the planet, an exoplanet crosses the star. You can see changes in the spectrum that tell you about that planet's atmosphere.
Oh, wow.
Now, the radial method, the radial velocity method, doesn't tell you about that. So these things give us different, depending on which method you get different information. But you try to put it all together into understanding of we're quite familiar these days with solar systems, stellar systems, I guess I should really say, of, you know, half a dozen or 10 planets sprinkled out in different distances around their stars. So the teasing out the various sort of signals that we can get, and various signals in the spectrum are mostly what we're talking about here, but also just in the overall light of the star when you get a transit, it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the star's light. Putting all that stuff together is a whole subspecialty of astronomy these days that didn't exist really 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Jim Lattice, our guest, you probably can figure he's the former manager of the Washburn Observatory. Should also mention his book, Chasing the Stars, which details the legacy of the UW-Madison Washburn Observatory. With the lunar eclipse getting set for tonight in Wisconsin, clear skies depending, and it's looking like we're going to get there. If you've got questions for our guest, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. So as we get to this near full solar eclipse tonight around...
Lunar eclipse,
thank you. And that is about, 11:13 you said?
Yeah, deepest eclipses, 11:13.
That's when our stars will be most vibrant, most bright.
Yep, and right, with any luck, we'll see the Milky Way arching overhead. I don't think that little bit of moonlight is going to be much different from a moonless night. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is a great time of year for the Milky Way. The summer Milky Way is very rich compared to the winter Milky Way. We see the other half in the winter sky, midwinter sky. So here we are in the summer, and the rich Milky Way stretches. Depends on exactly what time you go outside later or earlier, but from all the way from the north, where it passes through Cassiopeia, which is a constellation a lot of people know, up across, high in the sky across something called the Summer Triangle. There are three bright stars up there, and the Milky Way passes right through them, and then down into the south towards the constellation Sagittarius, which is. When you're looking at Sagittarius, you're looking in the direction of the center of the galaxy. We're not at the center of the galaxy. We're out two-thirds or whatever out from the center. So where is that from where we are in the disk? Well, it's towards Sagittarius. So you can look, scan over there with your binoculars. You can't see it, actually, but you're looking in the direction of the center of the galaxy over there, which is in our sky is going to be in the south-southwest sky before it goes down. In the evening.
Peer into the center of our galaxy.
Yeah.
Find Sagittarius and look deeper you will see.
If you could see in radio instead of optical light, if you could see in radio waves, you would see a bright source right down there in Sagittarius, because that black hole at the center of our galaxy.
Is that what's at the center of our galaxy?
Yeah, yeah. There's a massive, very massive black hole right at the center of the galaxy. Again, you can't see it. It's a black hole. But stuff is going on around it that produces a lot of radio radiation. And so you would see a bright thing down there if we could see it with radio eyes.
What are your feelings about apps for identifying constellations and what are in the night skies? You don't have to use them, but do they help others?
I do use them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do use them. They're often very handy for a number of things, especially if, like, somebody asks me, what time does something rise or set?
Okay, and you can just look it up on the app.
Yeah, sure, right.
You want to name any app in particular?
I use two apps. On my laptop, I use something called Stellarium.
Stellarium.
And at stellarium.org, you can download the version that runs on Windows and Macs and Linux on basically on laptops or desktop computers.
Sure.
And it's very capable. I use it a lot in preparing for these kind of things or in giving talks or something. But for an app, for a mobile device, Stellarium does make a mobile version. It's different from the laptop version. So you don't get quite the functionality on the mobile version, but it's free. And then there's another one that I like to use of the many that are out there. There's one called Sky Safari.
Sky Safari.
And there's also a free version of that. But then they have a couple, you can upgrade, you know, to a couple of different levels. So normally I upgrade to the next level because that lets me control telescopes with that software.
What? Wait.
The free version won't control your telescope.
But you can control your telescope with the app and then coordinate the two.
Yeah, it's really great. You can do things like indicate on the screen where you want the telescope to point in the sky and it'll go right over there. Or you can give it the name, a catalog number or something like that of an object or a star. Give the app that information and the telescope, and it'll steer the telescope over there. So, but yeah, you got to pay a little bit extra, and then Sky Safari is constantly bugging me to upgrade again.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Well, that's just part of the app process.
Part
There's
of the
nothing
whole world
you can do
of,
about
of
that.
That kind of thing. Yeah. So those are my preferred apps. There are a number of them out there. The one thing I don't find so useful, most of them will do the thing where if you hold it up
into the sky.
Yeah, right. Then it tells you, it says, oh, this is where you're looking or whatever. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I never find that particularly useful.
I can see where an astronomer might not.
It's so hard to relate what's going on that little screen to what's actually out there in the sky. But if it helps you, great, you know.
You got this little 5x7-inch screen versus infinity and beyond out there. So how do you apply the two?
Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm a constellation novice. I can find Orion just about any time, but the rest of them I kind of struggle to. I mean,
you can find the Big Dipper, right?
Big Dipper I can do, and Orion I can do, but the rest of them I kind of need some sort of guide to get me there.
Well, you know, so what we usually teach is those constellations that you do recognize. Mm-hmm. So you look up there and you see Orion. You use that to find your way to other constellations, so the ones that are immediately around it. Like Orion's Belt will point you one way, it points to Taurus, and in the other direction, it points to Canis Major. So you use the thing you already know to star hop, they often call that, star hop around to other spots in the sky. It's not hard. We should go out and stargaze.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I just didn't want to say it out loud. And you know, when you say it like that, star hopping seems like I could get started on this at any time. Maybe tonight with the lunar eclipse wouldn't be a bad place
to
start.
Take a little star chart out with you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In fact, I think I mentioned in the notes, you can get a free printable star chart from skymaps.com.
Skymaps.com.
Yeah, go to skymaps.com, download their free star chart, and print it, and then and you're all ready.
I can start with Orion and then work my way.
Well, not tonight. Orion will not be up tonight. Sorry, but you can start. You can start with the Big Dipper over in the.
There you go. I can find that. I can get started, and you can too at skymaps.com with a lunar eclipse tonight across Wisconsin and beyond. Our guest is Jim Lattice, taking us through space itself. We still got the planets to talk about, because some of those can be found in our night sky as well. And any questions you have at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. We'll continue to peruse the heavens next. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to WPR News. Don't miss that lunar eclipse tonight, and the umbra portion will take place from about 9:30 till just before 1 o'clock, and we'll get a near total eclipse around 11:13. Spoken like a radio guy. Around 11:10, I think, how most people say it. I'm radio guy Lee Rayburn. We're here with space guy Jim Lattice, former director of the UW Space Place, former manager of the Washburn Observatory at UW-Madison, and author of Chasing the Stars, the story of the legacy of the Washburn Observatory. And you're welcome to our conversation about space today at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Suzanne in Madison next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello, I have a story I'm very fond of about the Big Dipper.
Yeah.
And I was in northern Wisconsin with wonderful friends. I'm sorry, northern Minnesota with wonderful friends out in the late night with a couple of them. And we were all staring up, laying on our backs on a boat, looking up at the sky. And we were all really quiet and retro, you know, meditative. And the one friend says, "One thing I've always been pretty proud of is I can always find the Big Dipper." That's the story.
Thank you, Suzanne. And I can relate to your friend immensely, because the one thing I can always find is Orion, but sometimes it's not even there.
But, well, Big Dipper is a great place to start. Could he or she actually find it? Sometimes it's pretty low in the sky, but out on a lake, you're probably in good shape.
But you can use star mapping with the Big Dipper the same way.
Sure.
Just all you find your locate or your constellation that works for you, and then you can work your way around the night sky from there.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Diane in Madison emailed to say she can predict where the sun will rise, follows it south and then north throughout the year. However, the moon seems to rise anywhere it wants. Sometimes it's far south. Then Diane sees it rising well to the north. Jim, is there an overall easy explanation that describes the position of moon rise throughout the month or year?
No, it is complicated, but there is, I mean, it's well established. So the moon's orbit is tilted a little bit with respect to the sun's motion, about 5 degrees. And so the moon can rise further south and further north than the sun can rise. So you will see moon rises that are much further north than the northernmost sunrise, for example. And then that pattern shifts. The two orbits, so when I said the sun's path, it's really the Earth's orbit.
Right.
But the two orbits, the moon's orbit and the Earth's orbit, about 5 degrees difference. But then those two orbits shift with respect to one another. So where the tip north or south is actually moves over a period of about 11 years. And so so you see differing patterns of how different the moonrise is from the sun. And then over the that's called the motion of the nodes of the moon's orbit is what the astronomers call that. When the nodes have come all the way around, the pattern will start over again.
So there is a pattern.
So there is a pattern, but it's relatively complicated compared to the sun's rising and setting.
That's an easy one to figure as the Earth moves around it, but then you've got the moon moving around the Earth, which is moving around the sun, and that can...
Yep, you have to keep all those straight.
Which an astronomer can do, or maybe an app, and maybe an app can help you with that. But yeah, Diane would like to figure it out for herself. But there's some guides for you, Diane, and I hope that helps. Planets in the night sky, Jim. Some of them easily seen by the naked eye. Some of them better seen with maybe binoculars or a telescope.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, we have the brightest one. In fact, it's pretty close to its brightest right now. We have Venus. If you look in the sort of the twilight sky, I don't know, like about 7 p.m. or something like that these days, I guess.
If you, let's see, I was just going to tap on it here because I've got stellarium going right here. It's at about magnitude minus four or brighter. So it's pretty bright.
Yeah.
Venus is close to its brightest right now. So if you look over there in the southwestern sky just after sunset, while the sky is still sort of twilight, there'll be a really, really bright object over there, and that's Venus. So it's easy to find.
Well, it's still too early for stars. So if you see a bright object in the after dusk, you've got to figure it's a planet.
Yep. Uh-huh. That's probably a pretty good rule. Yeah. So, yeah, Venus is gets brighter than any of the rest of them. But then it's interesting if you do in that the short time, it's not going to be above the horizon very long because the sun has just set there and Venus is going to go down. But if you can get a telescope on it, it's kind of interesting right now because it's looks a little bit like a quarter moon, like what some people call a half moon. It's not a full disk. Because we're seeing Venus's orbit is inside of ours. So we sometimes, in fact, about half the time we see its night side and its daytime side in some mixture, which is why we're seeing the...
So we get Venus at...
I think it looks like the phases of the moon.
Yeah. It's got night and day, and we can see both night and day on the planet.
Right. There's whatever the side facing away from the sun is the night side, of course. Same with the moon, the phases of the moon. We're seeing the night and the day side of the moon. But things that are outside the Earth's orbit, like, say, Mars, we can't see behind them.
Sure.
So we never really see the night side. So Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, none of them do phases the way Venus does. So the phase of Venus right now is kind of fun to look at if you've got a small telescope.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's our only bright planet until a little bit later at night. Let's see, Saturn rather is I think already up at sunset, but it's pretty low. Let me just see if I can check exactly when it rises. This is of course where the software comes in really really handy. Saturn of course is everybody loves to look at.
Yes.
To look at Saturn. And so,
through the telescope, you can see its rings. And I always thought that was the neatest thing.
Yes. And so so you want to, looks like, no, it's not going to rise. I need another hour here. 7, 8. Yeah, so it's rising around 8 p.m., but it's pretty low on the horizon still. So 9 or 10 is better by then. In fact, I just noticed, I hadn't noticed this before, but that's set for, that'll be tomorrow. A couple of days from now, the moon, the waning gibbous moon, is going to be real near Saturn. So if you wait until like Sunday night,
that'll be Saturn easy to find.
Yeah, Saturn is just will be just right below the moon. Anyway, Saturn is fairly easy to find because there aren't any other real bright stars over there. Now it's not as bright as Venus by a long shot, it'll be fairly prominent over there in the eastern sky. Say about 10 p.m. I'm getting it high enough above the horizon there. So yeah, you can find Saturn. Look at that with your telescope. But then all the rest of the planets, I should say, really the other two that we typically look for, which are Jupiter and Mars, they're rising in the early morning before the sun.
Okay.
So you got to be an early morning
or a late night.
Or a late night. Yeah. I mean, it's let's see. We could just check that real quick here.
But is Jupiter like Saturn? If I were to look at it through a telescope, would I get some detail on the planet?
Oh yes. Oh yeah. In fact, Jupiter is a lot of fun to look at. Through even a small telescope, even binoculars, if you can hold them good and steady, will show you the moons of Jupiter. So it has four bright moons, which are often called the Galilean moons, because that's what he discovered with one of his earliest telescopic discoveries, was that Jupiter has these four bright moons orbiting around them, around it. And you can see those easily with a small telescope. But like I said, even binoculars, if you hold them good and steady. But it's really fun to look at. If you follow up a little bit, if you look at them the next night, you'll see they've all moved. So you can actually see the orbiting happening if you look night after night, which is what Galileo did. He sketched the order, looked the next night, sketched them again, next night, sketched them again. And what he first thought were stars in the background, he said, those things are actually orbiting around Jupiter, which we're talking 1610 here.
Yeah.
In 1610, the rule was everything orbits around the Earth.
That's right.
Yeah. So this was, anybody could see it. Anybody could see it. There's stuff orbiting around Jupiter. So the Earth is not the only center of motion in the universe.
That was a big moment in astronomy.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's a tough argument to make in a world that thinks that it is the center of its universe. You're facing an uphill battle on that one.
Yeah, yeah. It took a few centuries to get that.
I was going to say, there is a lesson to be learned in there somewhere, but we'll save that for another day.
Right. It's fun to look at that. You're kind of reproducing a very important historical moment,
the
recognition of what something's going on in the universe out there. And
it always seems so unreal to me because it's so far away. And yet when you look at it through a telescope, it is right there in front of you. And it feels like, it makes it real, but it's still...
Yeah, well, one of the objections, about the only objection that people could make to Galileo was, well, you must have built those into that telescope somehow.
The moons are part of the lens.
Right, they're somehow, or you made it wrong and there's reflections or something. But
for
anyway,
amateur astronomers, Jim, when you talk about telescopes, do I need to spend hundreds of dollars? What kind of a telescope would I need in order to enjoy the night sky, in order to see Jupiter's moons and Saturn's rings? What would you recommend?
So a fairly modest telescope would do either of those things. We used to sell, they're out of production now. There used to be a thing called a Galileo scope the magnification was about 25 power, which is a little stronger than typical binoculars.
Yeah.
About double what typical binoculars would be. That telescope showed you Jupiter's moons quite easily.
Okay.
And it was easy to put on a camera tripod. So anyway, those things are hard to find now, but a pretty modest telescope will do Jupiter's moons, and Saturn's rings are a little bit more of an ask, but not much. They're a little bit hard for, say, binoculars to see Saturn's rings.
But I'd be
rings.
Looking for about 25 times magnification or thereabouts?
At least. Although magnification is the issue with things like planets. It's not so much the issue with other star clusters or nebulas, things like that.
Those are so far away, they'd be tough to get close to.
Well, they are far away. They're much lower light level. And so what you need there, then we begin to talk not so much about magnification, but what we call aperture. That is how large the lens or the mirror of your telescope is.
Well,
so
that sounds like you're talking about price.
Well, yes. you can find kits and things like that. At least there used to be kits out there for a couple hundred dollars, something like that. But these days to buy a complete one is probably a lot easier than building your own. And I think around $300 you can get a type of telescope. There's a particular configuration called a Dobsonian telescope.
Dobsonian.
Yeah. And so if you look for a Dobsonian, I think probably around $300 these days. Prices have been going up, so I'm not really sure where they stand right now.
But when you talk about aperture, you sure do make a good case for an observatory like the Washburn Observatory, which has, I think, open hours where people can visit if they want.
It does, indeed. And so that's what I was actually going to say that about Jupiter was if you get a chance to look through the Washburn telescope at Jupiter or Saturn.
Yeah.
That'll knock your socks off, and you're not going to have a size telescope in your backyard. So, the Washburn Observatory has been open to the public. We're very proud that started in 1881, and the policy was that it would be open to the public on the first and third Wednesday nights of the month. This is pre-Wisconsin idea time, but it was already the astronomers established that policy. They wanted to share Wisconsin's observatory with Wisconsin's people. So, first and third Wednesday nights of each month, if the sky is clear. And then during the summer, actually, they expand that to every Wednesday night, June, July, and August. So we're getting towards the end of that. So in September, it'll be first and third Wednesday. So, you watch for what might be a clear night and go up to Washburn Observatory on the UW campus.
Fun field trip.
Great. Yeah.
Very different kind of date. I think it would be a wonderful opportunity.
I would think it would be a great date.
Jim Lattice is our guest. He's a former manager of the Washburn Observatory on the UW-Madison campus and wrote the book on it, Chasing the Stars, The Legacy, which details the legacy of the Washburn Observatory. Want to invite you to the conversation. I have some emails here to get to, but you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Kate and Ephraim emailed to ask if, Jim, if you're familiar with a Connecticut Yankee in the King Arthur's Court and what that has to do with astronomy.
Well, I suppose, yes, I am. And I suppose the question is referring to the episode there in that book where the Connecticut Yankee happens to have an ephemeris in his pocket, and he knows that on the date that he's there, there's going to be a solar eclipse. And so he uses that to impersonate a magician. I'm going to make the sun disappear if you don't do what I want.
But there's a bigger story here about how what we don't understand we can attribute to magic, but the deeper we get into space, the more we understand. And while it is... And the more we understand, the magical the science seems to be.
I have a friend who likes to say knowledge is always better than ignorance. And so the Connecticut Yankee there has leverage because he knows what's going on and everybody else doesn't. But it's interesting, though. Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, swiped that from none other than Christopher Columbus.
Really?
There was an episode. I forget which of his voyages, maybe the second, not the first one. Right. And he used it to intimidate the native inhabitants of the island where he was trying to get supplies and food and things like that. And he had an ephemeris. He had the latest version from Europe. This is 1490 something. He had the latest ephemeris, which allowed him to predict not a solar eclipse, but a lunar eclipse. And he did exactly what the Connecticut Yankee did. So Samuel Clemens picked up on that and changed it into a solar eclipse for the Connecticut Yankee.
Isaac emailed to shout out UW Stevens Point's Blotcher Planetarium. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, the planetarium down there, yeah.
They have Sunday shows in the afternoon, and the professor who runs it is amazing, very informative, very interesting. They also do stargazing at one of the sports fields on certain nights of the week. Cool stuff for folks who are around Stevens Point interested in the space, in the stars, Everybody is at some point to some degree because it is still that element of mystery.
The planetariums and observatories are really great, and if you got one nearby, another thing, if you're interested in astronomy, there are a lot of astronomy clubs.
Yeah.
Around the state. Madison has the Madison Astronomical Society, for example, which I'm active in. You can often find an astronomy club nearby you who will have an observatory and have telescopes and things like that. And they often will, for special events, maybe it's a meteor shower or an eclipse or something like that, they'll have a star party of some sort. So they're great resources, too.
Dark sky is also an important resource when you're talking about stargazing, and that seems to be something that is becoming less and less common. And you understand the importance of this, but anybody who wants to be able to stargaze would understand the importance of this. You are going to some pretty dark skies this weekend, as I understand it, up north to the Copper Falls to give a guided tour.
Wisconsin has some really great dark skies, especially up in the north.
Yes.
Right. The dark sky movement is really important, and International Dark Sky Association. I should have mentioned that. So thanks for bringing it up. I'm going to be up at Copper Falls State Park doing a Universe on the Park program on Saturday night, so I'm looking forward to that. Also up north, have an actual dark sky preserve at Newport Park over there in Door County. We have a, Rib Mountain, there's a dark sky preserve there. And let's see, there's another one that I was trying to think of that they're trying to get organized. Anyway, these things are cropping up where people are paying more attention now to, all it really takes is, for the most part, is just lighting, making appropriate choices when it comes to lighting.
It's another conservation movement, isn't it?
It often amounts to conservation in two ways. One is that a lot of the irresponsible lighting is wasting energy because it's just beaming light up into the sky where we don't need it. But the other conservation aspect is wildlife, because the lighting really affects a lot of wildlife in various sorts of ways. So the dark sky preserves, I think, are really important, and it's encouraging to see people paying more attention to that these days.
Jim Mordecai emailed to say he has visual snow syndrome, which means he has a fine-grained, moving, mostly transparent static over everything in his field of view, so he's visually impaired. Hmm. It doesn't bother him much except when he's trying to stargaze. It's difficult for him to tell if some of the tiny points of light are stars or a static from his visual snow, especially in places with more light pollution. As we mentioned, any advice for what Mordecai can do about this impairment? Because he would love to be able to watch the stars.
Ooh, that's a tough one. No, that's pretty far outside of my specialties.
Are there other ways to? I mean, are there, like, you talked about radio waves and stuff like that? Are there other ways to perceive our night skies?
Well, you know, one thing that still sticking with the optical, there are amateur radio telescopes, but maybe there are a number of new telescopes out just in the last few years that have integrated cameras in them. And so you actually control it, say, from your iPad, and it creates an image which it transmits to your iPad. So you see it on that screen much, much brighter than it would have been if you were looking, say, through an equivalent eyepiece.
Okay.
Now, it's doing other tricks too, like taking multiple exposures and stacking them up and things like that.
And I imagine it saves those images as well, so
you can go back and look at them,
maybe clean them up if you have to.
You can definitely do that. Some of the new ones will even do things like automatically create mosaics, so something that's too big for the telescope.
Yeah.
It'll take a bunch of them and then stitch them together.
You did at the observatory, didn't you?
Well,
something like that?
Vaguely like that, yeah. we're pretty low-tech. The Washington Observatory is pretty... We're talking 1879 here. So.
I've got a couple minutes left, but I want to get to Tom in Spring Green before we're done. Tom, hi.
Hello. This is Tom, and I was an assistant scoutmaster, and we went to Starved Rock in Illinois, and there was an amateur observatory group that was there. And one fella, he said, "You see Orion?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, look on one of the legs. We're on the upper, the lower of that leg, and look through the telescope. And what do you see?" And I looked and I saw a galaxy. And he said, "That was the Andromeda galaxy." I thought it was really amazing because it was something in which that, like you were saying about Galileo, we aren't alone.
Well, so the Orion Nebula, I think maybe you're thinking about the Orion Nebula in the constellation Orion. The Andromeda galaxy is kind of on the other side of the sky from that. So not in the constellation Orion. It's in the constellation Andromeda, which is why it's called that.
But the idea that it gave Tom, I mean, just that image, that view led to a whole world of
the Orion Nebula is really closely studied because stars and worlds are forming out there in the Orion Nebula. It's the closest star-forming region to our part of the galaxy. Right. So it's been much studied, yeah. And easily visible in binoculars, by the way.
Before we're done, we had a caller a couple weeks ago who asked about the Kessler syndrome. Are you familiar with this? The idea that there's so many satellites in the sky that they could begin to have a domino effect and impact each other. Are you concerned about the amount of lower Earth orbit satellites and its effect, like the dark skies, on being able to observe the stars?
Yes, I certainly am. It's not just the number of satellites. There's a one project that wants to put a huge mirror up there to beam sunlight down into the dark, into the night. And I don't know, I guess they'll sell you some sunlight or something. It's a little bit crazy because the plans for putting satellites up, the numbers are just huge. Yeah. And it means you'll never look up into the sky and not see satellites going by. And whether we would ever have that avalanche effect that you're talking about, that would be a true cataclysm. I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows what density of satellites you have to get to before that kind of thing can happen.
We know that it's getting more dense out there.
Whatever
we know
it is,
that it's getting harder to get past that, to get to the stars and the sky and the planets that we can see. Although at least we'll still have our lunar eclipse tonight.
That's right. That's right.
Jim Lattice, what a pleasure. I want to invite you back, and I want to thank you as always for joining us and sharing your love of space.
Happy to do it. Thanks
for translates. The... Even if I can only find Orion, the rest really speaks to me.
We'll work on that.
I'm looking forward to it. Jim Lattice is a former director of the UW Space Place, former manager of the Washburn Observatory, and now retired as a faculty associate in astronomy with the UW-Madison College of Letters and Sciences. The lunar eclipse tonight, beginning at 8:24 and rolling all the way till about 2 a.m. With a big part's the Umbra portion, as I learned from 9:34 to 12:52. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.